Good afternoon. So, last time, we started by finishing up talking about set associative caches, and we mentioned, well, with these associative caches, now we have multiple places we can store each block, and now this means that we need to make decisions sometimes. We need to decide which of several options are we going to use. So we talked about what we called replacement policies. For when that decision was tough, well, we were replacing something else when we inserted something into our cache, and we needed to decide what policy we'd have about what we do for that. And we mentioned that if we believe in our locality assumption, if we believe that we have good temporal locality, we want to do least recently used. We want to replace the thing that is least recently used because our temporal locality tells us that's least likely to be used in the future. We mentioned that we can implement this LRU policy, but when we get more than two or three ways, this actually becomes very tedious and expensive as far as the bookkeeping we need to do in the hardware. And if we think about what I said about locality, locality is this kind of assumption about how programs work. And it's not always completely true. So, you know, it's kind of just an approximation of the program's behavior anyway. So there's not actually, you know, that much to gain by exactly doing least recently used, as long as we do the important thing of making sure that we avoid replacing things that are definitely in active use over things that are definitely in inactive use. And for that reason, real processors, when we have multi-way caches, typically end up implementing an approximation of LRU, where the bookkeeping is simpler, but they get those important attributes that they're, you know, not replacing something that's obviously more in use than other things in the set. Also mentioned that, well, you know, maybe the bookkeeping you have to do for those approximations of LRU is still too much. Because it's work you have to do to update some metadata when you have just reads. You know, even if you're using an approximation, you better be doing that, because if you're reading something a lot, you better keep track of that somehow. So we have these replacement policies that you can use which don't require that, that are simpler. So first in, first out is one where we just keep a counter, and we just random. We can just, you know, say, you know, I'm not going to keep track of anything. I'm just going to make a random choice every time. And these are a lot easier to implement, and they're not that much worse. They're worse. Like, you'll get a, you know, some noticeable difference in the miss rate, but they're so much simpler to implement, and they're not so much worse because we have this sort of phenomenon where, you know, if we make a bad decision with these policies about what to replace, it's going to be brought back into the cache anyways, and probably we won't repeat that exact same bad decision again, at least not soon. So after talking about replacement policies, I started talking about something we'll get back to today about, well, if I have, you know, cache misses and I want to think about how can I make my cache better, one thing we want to think about is sort of what blame we can assign for each type of misses. And we have this categorization of misses where it says that some misses are compulsory or cold misses. These are misses where I'm starting something up and I'm reading it or writing it for the first time. So of course it can't be in the cache. And counting these misses is useful because if you run a program and you see you have a, you know, 3% compulsory miss rate, well, nothing you're doing to make the cache bigger or make the cache have, you know, more ways or anything like that is going to fix that problem. Because, you know, you have to access those things the first time. Mentioned conflict misses. So if we think about having our sets, sometimes we have misses because just too many things are using the same set, even though there might be space elsewhere in the cache. So conflict misses are, you know, if we didn't have this problem of only being able to store something in a particular set, we could avoid this miss. And then we have capacity misses, so which is everything left over. And these are things where, you know, if we're keeping the block size the same, what we have to do is just make the cache bigger. So, for example, if you see lots of capacity misses, you know, fiddling with the associativity, probably not a useful strategy. And these are sorts of things that people look up look at with simulations to like simulate the cache and count what type of miss each thing is, in order to think about, well, how should I change the cache in this processor to run these programs better? So questions about replacement policies or mistypes? Yes. That's what we'll get to next. I guess, yes, back there.
How is capacity different from conflict?
So how is capacity different from conflict? So a conflict miss is something where if we didn't have the problem of needing to choose a set, the miss would go away. So the way we would usually count them is we would simulate a cache with one set. So if I had one giant set, and a good replacement policy for that, we'd avoid those misses. So if you remember our examples of access patterns, like we had cases where we were having misses, but there was a set with an unused block. So that's definitely a conflict miss because we could, if we didn't have to worry about what set it had to go to, we could store it there. So conflict means that if we could have used space in other indices, we could have found a way to avoid this being a miss without causing a substantial number of other misses. So basically, the problem is that we've assigned this to a particular index, and that's not really the optimal way of splitting up the values that are being accessed. So another way of thinking about it is there's something about the distribution of the indices, which is uneven, that's causing this miss, versus an actual sort of problem with how big the cache is. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so on to our second topic, which was about write policies. And there's two important write policy decisions we talked about. So one was this write allocate versus write no allocate. So this is all about the behavior when we don't have a value cached and there's a write. So in that case, we have to decide, if it's not in my cache now, do I want it in my cache? With reads, we always decided we're going to put it in the cache. We said, reads likely to be accessed again in the future. We want to have that data there. We're going to put it in the cache every time there's a read and it's not in the cache. With writes, we don't make the same decision. So with writes, you have some caches, which are write allocate, where they do the same thing we do with reads, that when we have a write, we're going to bring that value into the cache. We're going to assume we're going to access it again later. And you have write no allocate caches, where we don't make that assumption, where we say, it's not worth bringing this into the cache, so we're not going to do it. So separately from that, we have a decision called write through versus write back. And this is all about if a value's in our cache and we're writing, do I also have to write to the next level? With write through, the answer is yes, I always do. So when it's in my cache, doesn't matter, I still have to write to the next level. With write back, we say if it's in our cache, we're not going to bother telling the next level until later. So to implement the write-back policy, we need to have a dirty bit to remember to tell them later. But the write-back policy only comes into effect if we've already made the decision that this value is going to be stored in our cache. If we haven't made that decision, doesn't matter. So questions about write allocate and write-back? Yes. So the question is, I mentioned that typically you'll see caches be either write allocate write back or write no allocate write through. But could we do other combinations? Absolutely. I think you typically won't see that, and probably the big reason why is that with a write back cache, we're kind of assuming that there's some advantage to storing things that are being written and rate allocates is trying to take advantage of the same kind of phenomenon. So just from a perspective of what are we optimizing for, they kind of make sense together. And if we're doing a write through policy, or I guess if we're doing a write no allocate policy, we're kind of assuming that things that we're writing to aren't necessarily accessed again soon for reads. So we're kind of making the same a different, you know, assumption about our programs. So they're kind of similar. So that's why they're probably usually together, but absolutely you could combine them in other ways. And there's probably some processor which has like a write allocate write through cache, but I just don't know what it would be. Yes, back there?
Could you explain like write hit versus like write miss?
Can I explain what a write hit versus a write miss is? So generally a hit is when we find the value in the cache without needing to get it. That's for a read or write. So the question is, with write through, then what is a write hit? So a hit in write through means that we found the value in our cache, but we're still going to go to the next level. And we'll talk today about, you know, because it seems right now, and I think your complaint is that it sounds like that's very expensive. But it turns out in practice it's not so expensive. And we'll look at why. Other questions? Okay. So some logistics. So the lab for this week, as some of you may have noticed, is Cache Lab. So it's a bunch of online exercises on cache parameters and cache access patterns. The homework is not related to the lab, so which is why I'm talking about it here. The homework is a pipeline simulator. So we're going to give you an instruction trace, and this is kind of similar to the output you'd get from your pipe homework too. So it doesn't, like, you know, tell us the results of the instructions, but it like gives you a list of, you know, these are the instructions we ran. So it's the instructions we ran, not the program. And it like says, this was the source register, this was the destination register, and so on. And based on that information about what are the instructions and what are their like source and destination registers, do they access memory, we have a Python-based simulator that basically tries to count cycles based on what your pipe homework 2 would do. So it looks for load use hazards by comparing the source and destinations and whether it's a memory operation. And it also looks for branch miss predictions. And it just counts how many cycles things would take. So your assignment is to make some modifications to use this simulator to test sort of other hypotheticals. What if the branch prediction worked differently? How many cycles would that make things be? What if we had a longer load use hazard? So your assignment is to do that and do some computations based on results, and also submit the Python code you use to do this. So the reason we have you submit the Python code you use to do this is mainly so if the numbers you get don't make sense, we can look at your Python code and see if you were doing something reasonable or not. We have you submit one Python file, but we have you do these sort of separate changes that are independent of each other. So we like want you to like test one thing without including all the other modifications, please. In my solution, I added command line options to the Python program so I could switch between the different parts. You could not do that if you want. You could like comment out the code as long as we can find it when we're checking things by hand. But I would recommend adding like a command line option or at least like a flag at the top of the file so you can easily go back to a previous problem without forgetting to uncomment something, since that will probably avoid issues. So questions on upcoming assignments? Yes? What? The question is, the program is in HDRS? No. So you're getting a trace, which is just sort of what the control signals would have been for HDLRS, and it's a Python program, like actually Python. Other questions? Okay. So when we finished up last time, we were looking at, I believe, this exercise, which we went through. So let's try this variation on it. So here, I just have a different write policy. So let's start with the first problem, which is writing a byte to address 0x33. So with this cache, will it perform a read from a value in memory and or a write to a value in memory? Assuming memory is the next level. And if it helps, we'll say that 0x33, remember this in binary, is looks like this. So our index bit is that one. Okay, who'd like more time? A couple people? Okay. Okay, so who thinks this would require reading a value from memory? Okay, who thinks this would require writing a value to memory? Okay, so and that is what I concur with. So this would require writing a value to memory. So this would write to memory. It also would write to the cache. Why would it write to the cache? Because the value, the byte we're writing, is already in the cache. And so we're going to update it, but because we have a write-through policy, we're also going to update the memory. And when we update it, we're also going to update this LRU information here to say that, oh, we do use that, just use that block there because we wrote to it. Questions about that? And with this write through cache, we don't have a dirty bit. And why don't we have a dirty bit? Because all of the values in the cache are the same as the values in memory. So, or at least the same as the next level's values. So we don't have to worry about, if we read something into the cache, updating memory for it. That's not going to be a concern. So when we do those reads, we're going to have to read something from memory because those two addresses aren't in the cache, but we're not going to have to write anything back because we're never replacing anything dirty because there's nothing dirty in the cache. Questions? Question, don't do... The other two have to read from memory, which is why there's read in bold. Other questions? Okay. So earlier, I promised that I'd explain why write through isn't horribly slow. Because it seems like, oh, you told me memory has this really slow, and we have to go to memory every time if we have, you know, write through caches in all our levels. And also, it would seem like even with write back, you know, replacing values could be really slow. We have to do two memory accesses, you know, and one memory access is pretty slow, but why would we double the time by doing this write as late as possible? And in practice, the effective speed of writes is a lot faster because of a strategy known as write buffers. So caches, when they talk to the next level, will typically have a small piece of storage for values that are currently being written. So as long as we're not writing too often, this won't fill up, and this will hold values while we're waiting for the memory to do its slow thing. So as long as our rate of writes isn't too high, we can hide the fact that they're slow by just saying that, yes, I finished the write, even though all I've really done is put it in this write buffer and started the write. And as long as the writes finish up before we run out of space in the write buffer, we can have them just finish essentially instantaneously. If we run out of space in the write buffer, of course, we're going to have to actually have the writes be slow. But as long as you don't do too much writing, this is not a concern. And this is, you know, why a write-through caches aren't a disaster. Because as long as you aren't doing too much writing, you know, you won't fill up this write buffer very often. And write-back caches, you know, you'll do even less writes generally because you're only writing a value basically when you're done accessing it. So that makes the overhead of the writes very low in effect. Just as long as you aren't doing too much writing. Question back there? What's the typical size of a write buffer? I've gathered it's order 10, but I don't know like real sizes. Order 10 writes. But yeah, I don't know what actual sizes are on anything modern. Yes?
If there was another corruption run by the CPU that wrote again to ABCD with a different value,
So the question is, let's say we're accessing something, you know, writing to something that's in the write buffer or reading from something that's in the write buffer, what happens?
Yeah.
So part of implementing the write buffer and something which makes this a bit more complicated is that we need to check the write buffer on both reads and writes to make it behave correctly. So on writes, it's actually less of a concern because we could maybe just have, if the write buffer is ordered, you know, we could just do the second write later. But on reads, we actually have to make sure we read the value that's in the write buffer, even if you know that write isn't finished yet. And that's part of why this is not the most trivial thing to implement. Other questions? Okay, and another thing that we've kind of glossed over with our caches is the sort of notion of hierarchy. So we mentioned that, I'm going to have a data cache, that's what our data memory really is, and an instruction cache. And on a modern processor, we typically have a lot of caches. So my desktop, for example, it has 4 cores. So basically 4 processors with their own register files and their own data and instruction cache. And those data and instruction cache have a second level of cache that's shared between the data and instruction cache, which is why I call it here a unified cache. And there's an L3 cache that's shared between all the cores. So in total, we have 13 caches on this one package. And one thing that I would like to mention is a problem, though we're not going to go into the many, many different strategies there are for dealing with it, is that if we modify something in, let's say, our data cache on one core, how do the caches on another core, or the L3 cache, know about that? We want to keep them all in sync, and that's something that real processors have to worry about. This is known as cache coherency. We're not going to talk about mechanisms for dealing with cache coherency in this class. It's commonly a topic in a more advanced architecture class, and obviously a very important one. And one reason I'm mentioning it is that this often influences a lot of other cache design decisions. So for example, whether you're write through or write back greatly affects how easy it is to implement this cache coherency solution. And it also might affect a whole bunch of other decisions about your cache, because this is actually a lot of the work you have to do in a modern cache design. So questions about our cache hierarchy? Yes?
Is write back generally
Question, is write-back generally more efficient than write-through in modern architectures? If we believe that Intel and AMD's current architectures are the most efficient design they could have chosen, they've all chosen write-back for their L1 and L2 caches. So that seems to be what they settle on. I'm not sure that's always most efficient. So like only a decade ago, I know AMD, I think it was AMD a decade ago had some processors with L1 write-through caches. So it's not an unheard of thing to use write-through, but they seem to have decided that for the workloads that they're targeting, write-back is the way to go. And I guess also for the sort of cache coherency algorithm they're implementing, they're comfortable doing a write-back policy. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk a little about measuring cache performance. So I talked about thinking about cache performance in terms of different types of misses. Another thing we want to think about is sort of like the components of like how fast memory is. And how often we have a hit is only one part of this. So a common metric that you'll see is something called average memory access time, which is basically if I'm talking to a cache, what's the average time until I get the value back that I'm trying to access? And we'll measure this as what we'll call hit time. So hit time is the time, if it's a hit, from when we ask for the value to when we get it. And we also have a miss penalty. So a miss penalty is the extra time, in addition to the time for a hit, that we have to spend to get the value on a miss. So typically, the way a cache would work is that on a miss, we'll do a work that takes as long as it would take for a hit, and then we'll detect, oh, there's a miss, and only at that point will we go to the next level. Now, we could have caches which don't quite work that way, which like start the access to the next level earlier than that. But typically, it's the case that, you know, in our examples, they won't. But hypothetically, you could have a cache where the miss penalty like has some overlap with, so not the miss has some overlap, but the miss penalty doesn't include all of the access to the next level because we can start it earlier. But typically, we won't. And that miss penalty is multiplied by the miss rate, so that's how often we have a miss. Sometimes you'll be given the hit rate. So the hit rate's related to the miss rate because they add up to 100%. And I've given sort of this first formula as the primary way of computing this, but we could also say that this is the same as the hit time times the hit rate plus the miss time. And the miss time is the total time for a miss, which includes the hit time and the miss penalty. But most commonly, we'll use this first formula because we'll find it easier to get the miss penalty because we'll be thinking about the miss penalty being the time spent going to the next level. And we can think of this as the effective speed of memory. So questions about this formula and the definitions of our terms? Yes. Question, I said the miss penalty, miss time includes both the miss penalty and the hit time, yes. So as an example, let's suppose a cache has a 10 cycle hit time, an 80% hit rate, and 100 cycle miss penalty. So if we wanted to use that formula, what's the first thing we should do? So our formula was hit time plus miss penalty times miss rate. So what's the first thing I should do to use this formula? Yeah.
Do 100 minus the hit rate to find the miss rate.
Yeah, so we need the miss rate. So a thing a lot of people do without realizing it is that they use the hit rate as the miss rate, and that will get you a very different answer. So once we do that, we get 30 cycles. Good. So this is sort of just a plug-in calculation. Let's do something a little more interesting. So let's say I have an L1 cache with a 3-cycle hit time and a 90% hit rate. And I have an L2 cache with the same parameters we just saw. We have an 80% hit rate. And note that I'm measuring that hit rate only for accesses that make it to the L2. So most of the time, 90% of the time, the L2 doesn't see what the CPU requests. And the hit rate is only measuring things that actually get to the L2. And main memory has 100 cycle access time. And let's assume that we don't have any overlap between sort of the hit process and the retrieving from the next level process. So if we have an L1 hit and an L1 miss and an L2 hit, that's going to be 10 plus 3 cycles. We aren't going to be able to like start the L2 access earlier. So there's a question back there. So the question is, what is miss penalty? Miss penalty is the extra time we spend on a miss that we wouldn't spend on a hit. And in this example, the miss penalty is composed entirely of the entire process of going to the next level. But we could imagine cache designs where maybe there's something else going on. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay. I'll finish before. Okay, who'd still like more time? Okay, so it seemed good. So who thinks the answer is 3 or less cycles? 4 or less cycles? 5 or less cycles, 6 or less cycles, 7 or less cycles. I should include 6, I guess, more than 7 cycles. Okay, so most people got 6 cycles, which is what I got. So our hit time for the L1 cache is 3. We're told that. And then 10% of the time, we need to also access the L2 cache. And to access the L2 cache, well, we have to spend 10 cycles to hit time. And 20% of the time, we need to spend an additional 100 cycles to talk to main memory. And this gives us a total of 6 cycles. Questions on this example? Yes, back there.
Why do you not multiply the 3 and the 10 by 0.9 and 0.8?
Question is, why am I not multiplying the 3 and the 10 by 0.9 or 0.8? Because I'm using the miss penalty here, using the version of the formula with our miss penalty. And a miss penalty is the time in addition to the hit time. So this is equal to the miss time minus the hit time. So we could also think of this as the time for a hit weighted by the number of hits plus the time for a miss weighted by the number of misses. But in that case, we wouldn't want to use the miss penalty because the miss penalty is kind of already taking that into account. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So, like with our types of misses, I think the most useful thing about this formula is not being able to compute exact values, but this is being a way to think of how to optimize caches, because this tells us sort of different aspects of the cache we can improve. So I'm going to talk about sort of the relationship between different changes we might make to a cache in hit time, miss rate, miss penalty. Before I do that, I'd like to give our warning about how, you know, locality works. So I can take any cache and make it look horrible. How do I do this? This is a generic way. First, access a bunch of stuff to fill up the cache. Then access something that's not in the cache. It's going to replace something. Then access the thing that was just replaced. So I can construct an access pattern for a cache which will be 100% misses. We'll make the cache look horrible. I can do this for any cache. But that's not what we're concerned about. We're concerned about programs that aren't written in this sort of malicious way. And the question is, what's the typical behavior going to be? So I'm going to show you, for example, what typically happens to miss rate when we increase associativity or increase cache size. But that doesn't mean every program is going to do that. That just means programs that aren't written, you know, to make the cache look bad are going to do that. Yes?
Can you remind me what increasing associativity means?
Question is, what does increasing associativity mean? That means adding more ways. So here I have a bunch of changes to the cache. So I have increasing the cache size, increasing the associativity while keeping the cache size the same, increasing the block size while keeping the cache size the same. And we can think of the effects they have on miss rate, hit time, and miss penalty. So you can see increasing the cache size and associativity, these are generally things that will decrease our miss rate. But the reason we don't have huge caches all the time is because they also increase our hit time. Also, the reason we don't have super high associativity all the time is that we generally increase our hit time because we have to do more attack comparisons. With block size, this is the relationship with miss rate is more complicated. If we have really small blocks, we aren't taking advantage of spatial locality. If we have really large blocks, then that means we have less blocks in our cache, so we can store less different things. And when we have larger blocks in general, this has an effect on hit time because, well, we have to, you know, on a hit, we have to extract the right part of a larger block. And on a miss, it increases the time because we have to bring in more stuff from memory. And This sort of way of dividing things up finally gives us a way to think about, like, why do we have an L2 cache? And an L2 cache gives us a way to attack that miss penalty term. So, like, typically we're thinking, oh, you know, memory is as fast as it is. So by adding a second level of cache, we can kind of make it look like the memory is a little faster. And actually a lot faster in this case, as we saw. Like 30 cycles versus 100, that's a big improvement by adding that L2 cache to the speed of what would look like memory and therefore a miss penalty. I mentioned that we have a few other policies that, you know, affect things. So write allocate probably helps our miss rate. And I say probably because this is assuming typical locality. But people who might deliberately not have write allocate on might assume that that's maybe not so true for writes. So questions on anything in this table? Yes. So how would increasing cache size increase the hit time? So the amount of time it takes to retrieve a set of the cache depends on the number of sets and also how wide those sets are. This with how the memory technologies we're going to use to store a cache work. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? And another way we can look at these sort of trade-offs is we can consider them in terms of the different kinds of misses we used earlier. So increasing the cache size decreases capacity misses and conflict misses. Why does it decrease conflict misses? Because it's less likely that two values will randomly have the same index if we have more sets. Increasing associativity decreases conflict misses. Increasing the block size decreases compulsory misses because we get more stuff for the first access to unblock. And probably increases other types of misses because we just effectively made our cache store less distinct things. We can think of all the other policies in this kind of way. And when we're designing a cache, this would be the sort of thing you'd look at to decide, like, what types of parameters do I want to tweak to try to get the best performance from my processor for the types of programs I want to run. Questions about this chart? Okay, so in that case, we're going to move from this sort of abstract world of qualitative cache optimizations to sort of very precise things and try to correlate cache accesses to C code. I'm going to start with this simple example. So I have a C code and I have the corresponding assembly. And I'm asking what data cache accesses do. I don't care about instruction cache right now, just data cache. So what are the data cache accesses made by this function? So can someone tell me any data cache access made by this function? Yes?
Need to access the value.
The value, which value?
The value variable.
The value variable. Okay. So the value variable, what does that correspond to in assembly? Anyone? EAX, that is what the return value corresponds to. So it corresponds to a calling convention, which is what you were thinking of, corresponds to EDI. So if you remember our pipe homework, we have a register file and the data memory. To access registers like EDI, we use the register file. We don't use the data memory. The data memory is our data cache. So accessing value, in fact, does not use the data cache. Because in this example, it's stored only in registers. Yes, back there? So scale factor, on the other hand, does. And so this move would be a memory to register move if this were y86. and that is accessing memory. So the global variable is at a fixed address that accesses memory. So that's one of our data cache accesses is going to be scale factor read. Okay. Question back there or another answer?
Another answer.
Okay. No questions? So I'll take other answers, other thing data cache accesses. Okay.
Instruction cache.
So the instruction cache. The instruction cache is not the data cache. Remember, I told you it was separate cache. So it's not something other. But there's one more data cache access here. This one is one that people often miss. But you, if you remember how you did type homework 2, you might see it. What?
The return.
The return. The return reads from the stack. So our two accesses are scale factor read and the reread of the return address. Those are both things which in your seek homework or pipe homework 2 would use the data memory to get those values. Okay. So let's think of using the scale factor function in a loop. And let's say each time it's called in the loop, we had these addresses. And let's say we have a direct map 32K cache with 64 byte blocks. What would these addresses tag index and offset be? And maybe we'll just be concerned, just for time reasons, about the index and offset. So how would I go about figuring this out? What would be a useful first step? Yeah. Okay, converting the addresses into binary. We'll do that on demand. That would be a good thing to do. Something else we want to do early? Way back there? Okay, take the log base 2 of those sizes. So this is a 2 to the 15 byte cache with 2 to the 6 byte blocks. So why did you want to take the log base 2? Okay, so that's going to help determine the size of the index and offset. So the offset is based on the block size. So we have 6 offset bits. And we have how many index bits? How do we determine the number of index bits from this information? So what quantity would be useful to know to know the number of index bits? Yeah.
Number of sets.
Okay. So each set has one block because it's a direct map cache. So we have 2 to the 15 over 2 to the 6 equals 2 to the 9 sets, which means we have 9 offset bits. So I can figure out where things are by converting the bits where the index and offset would be into binary. So I have 6 offset bits here. So that's going to be R1000 and B is 111 going that way. So our offset is there, so that's 0x38 for the return address. And our index, well, we need some more bits, so we need the 3 here. 1 and the 4. And I carefully read these up, and I get 1011 as the bottom bits. So which is E as the last hex digit, and then a 0, and then a 1. So I get 10E. So questions on how I did that conversion? So I just wrote out the bits for the, you know, the last 15 bits is all I needed, so I looked at those to get our numbers. So, I worked out in advance because doing this is actually a little bit tedious what the numbers are. So we can see one thing which happened here is that I have two values with the same index. This is the sort of thing I mentioned could happen by accident. Is this realistic? Well, obviously I made it up for this example, but this sort of thing sometimes happens, and there's a reason why you typically don't see a direct map cache on a modern processor. But this is the sort of thing we do to like figure out exactly what accesses would happen. And in this case, we have an access to the return address, an access to the scale factor interleaved. So with the direct map cache, everyone would be amiss. It'd be amiss because it'd be amiss when we access scale factor because we previously accessed the return address, and that's what's in the cache. And when we access the return address, we previously accessed scale factor, so that would be amiss. And you know, we'd hope this wouldn't happen. So now let's go through maybe a more realistic example, but we'll start with toy sizes. So here I have an array. I'm computing an even sum and an odd sum by going through the array, some of the even elements, some of the odd elements. And let's say, just to start out simple, that I have a one set direct map cache. So my cache has one block, and the block is 8 bytes. And ints are 4 bytes, so 2 array elements fit in the block. And my question is, how many data cache misses? I'll give you a minute. How many data cache misses are there? And assume that, as I mentioned, that only the array is in the data cache. Everything else uses registers only. And that the cache is initially empty, so we have to bring everything into the cache to access it. Would like some more time? A couple of people, okay. Question? Yeah, okay. So let's see. So who thinks we have one miss? Two misses? Three misses? More than three misses? Four misses? Okay. So there's some information I didn't give you here. And that's how these cache blocks correspond to array elements. So we know we have in memory an array, so 4-byte elements all together, so we have 16 bytes of stuff. And it could be the case that we have a cache block containing the first two elements and a cache block containing the next two elements. In this case, we get our answer of 2 that almost all of you came up with. And what would happen is we'd read array 0. That would bring in 0 and 1 because they're in the same block. Then we read array 1. That would be a hit. Then we read array 2. That wouldn't be in the cache because that's not 0 or 1. We bring in 2 and 3. So 3 would be a hit after 2 was a miss. But the array doesn't need to be placed like this. It could be placed like this. In this case, we read array 0, and we bring in array 0 and some junk from before the array. Then we read array 1, bring in array 1 and 2. Then we read array 3, and bring in array 3 and some junk after the array. And this would be 3 misses. Questions about this alternate case? Okay. We also could have a more complicated scenario where maybe the array is at a weird address, so it's, you know, so each some individual elements are mixed between two cache blocks. This would also result in 3 misses, but we'd have to do multiple cache accesses for each array access. Questions about this scenario? Yeah.
In a real process, are there ways to like avoid this weird case so that you're not doing all of the extra unnecessary memory?
So the question is, are there ways to avoid this weird case? And absolutely, and compilers are the big thing which does it. So compilers and malloc implementations typically do what we call aligning values. So they'll typically, when you, for example, have an array of ints, they'll try to make sure that the array starts on a multiple of the size of an int in order to prevent values from being split up across cache blocks. Because, in fact, while like, for example, x86 processors will do this, it is a bunch slower. So let's do another example. And this time, I'm going to give you the assumption that array 0 is at the beginning of a cache block. But we have a slightly different way of doing this, so I'm computing the even sum than the odd sum. The question is, how many cache misses do we have now? Same one block cache. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, not seeing any. So who thinks we have 2 or fewer misses? Okay, couple. 3? 4? More than 4? Okay, so our priority answer is 4. And that's what I get to. So remember, our cache has one block. So initially, our cache is empty. And then we, and I'm going to just write a table of what the values in the caches are, caches. So then we access array of 0. And this is going to be a miss, because our cache is initially empty. And we're going to bring in 0 and 1. Those are going to be the two elements in our cache. Then we are going to access array of 2. That's going to be a miss, because it's not 0 or 1. And that means we have a one-block cache. We have to replace the block in the cache. So our cache's contents become 2 and 3. So then we access array of 1. That's going to be another miss, because now our cache has 2 and 3 in its single block. So that gives us, puts 0 and 1 in the cache, because on a miss, we bring in what we just accessed. And then we access array of 3. That's going to be another miss, and we're going to end up with 2 and 3 in the cache, but 4 misses. And basically, from a higher level perspective, what happened here is I got rid of some spatial locality I previously had, and now things perform worse. That my cache let me take advantage of spatial locality. When I got rid of that spatial locality, my performance went down. So questions on how I figured out this example? Okay, so working with this one block cache, that's kind of silly, so let's expand. So here I have something similar to our first example with 8 elements instead of 4. And I'm asking about a two-set direct map cache. So we have 2 rows, still one way, but 2 rows. I'm asking how many misses are there. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have, let's start with 2 or fewer misses, 3 misses, 4, okay, 5 or 6 misses, 7 or 8 misses, more than 8 misses, okay, so most people figured out 4, and the way I would figure this out, well, we have to think about, so if we want to do a full simulation of this, we want to think of, okay, how do these things map to our different sets? And so what I'll do for analyzing this is I will assume that array 0 maps to index 0. Now, that might not be the case. It might be index 1. We have index only index 0 and 1. Those are the only possibilities. But if it's not, everything I do is going to work. I'm just going to have to change the number of the rows. And, you know, if I just renumber the rows in my cache, it's going to behave the same as long as I renumber my addresses accordingly. So I'm just going to assume for my analysis that index 0 includes array 0, but I'm going to get the same answer if it's index 1 instead. I'm just swapping 0 and 1 everywhere. And if index 0 contains array 0 and array 1, then the next block has to be an index 1. And that would be what contains array 2 and 3. And the block after that, well, we would say it's an index 2, but we've run out of space in our cache. We only have two rows. So it's going to be an index 0. And sort of this is a consequence of the index bits being right before the offset bits. This is sort of how things are going to end up being laid out. So I can do this sort of full simulation, which looks like this, that I just keep track of set 0's contents, set 1's contents at every step. And I find out that we have a miss followed by a hit, followed by a miss, followed by a hit. And repeat that, and that's why we have 4 misses. So questions about this sort of way of figuring things out? Yes? Question is, isn't this the same as we would get with one set? Yes, it is. So we didn't actually get any advantage for having a two-set cache. Other questions? So something notable about thinking of caches this way is that the sets work independently of each other. What happens with set 0 doesn't affect what happens with set 1, because we only access set 0 when we have things with index 0. We only access set 1 when we have things with index 1. So that means a way we could have gone about this is we could have done two separate subproblems. We could have said, I'm going to look at the accesses to set 0 and count the misses there, and I get 2. And I'm going to look at the accesses to set 1 and count the misses there and get 2. Or more usefully, we could have noticed, I look at the accesses at 0, I get 2, and I realize, wait, set 1's going to have the same pattern. So it's also going to be 2 in this case, because we have everything's very similar. So this sort of thing is really useful for like doing this analysis, practically speaking, because we can just look at one set at a time and not have to keep track of all these extra values. Like, you know, here I'm only keeping track of a very small part of that table, and the same thing here. And that makes this tractable to do when, you know, we have a more realistic cache where we might have, you know, not two sets, but like, you know, 128. We can instead say what happens for set 0, and then what happened, is that going to be the same for every set? We've done our analysis versus actually like having 128 columns on this chart. Okay, so any other questions about this idea of splitting it up by which set we're accessing? Okay, so next time, keeping in sync with the morning lecture, this is where we ended there without solving this problem. Next time we'll look at, you know, this sort of doing the same thing as before, where now I'm doing the evens alone and the odds alone, so I'm decreasing my locality. And then we'll advance on to, you know, here I've dealt with these toy cache sizes of like two sets. We'll apply our idea about, oh, we can analyze a set together to extend this to something more realistic, like the actual size of an L1 cache. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today.